Good. So a couple of weeks ago, I was invited to this sukkah of a Holocaust survivor by the name of Saul Teichman. Okay, and he's pretty famous actually in Los Angeles and also in different places around the world. And he sort of told me his story, and then he gave me his book, which I have it here. Yeah, and this is the book. And so he says that he gives this book out, and he basically wants people who read it to write him a note that said, like, you know, what did you get out of it? And he's collecting these notes. So I read the book over Sukkot, and I wrote him a letter about what I thought about it. And this is, I'll just read you the opening paragraph, okay? I was humbled to have been invited to your sukkah, and even more so after reading the story of your life in your book, The Long Journey Home. I have, of course, read and learned about the horrors of the Holocaust, the closure of Jewish businesses, the confiscation of Jewish homes, the Yellow Star, the ghettos, the insults, humiliations, beatings, the crowded boxcars that led to the unimaginable Auschwitz, Warsaw, death march to Dachau, and finally waiting for camp liquidation as the Nazis lose the war. What I found astounding from reading your book is that you witnessed it all, lived it all, suffered it all, and survived it all. And you did not just survive, you thrived. How you were able to maintain your sanity and your faith to go on and live such a productive and successful life is a testament to the eternity of the Jew. So now, what I would like to do in this shiur is really figure out, how does somebody maintain their sanity? How does somebody maintain their faith? How does somebody go on to not just survive, but thrive? I mean, and become a successful businessman, to raise a thriving family. The whole works, right? I mean, after you've been through such a trauma, you wouldn't expect somebody to be able to just get up and keep going strong. And really, what does it mean, the eternity of the Jew? What is the secret of the eternity of the Jew? Now, I want to try to answer those questions through the parasha of Noah and the story of the flood. Now, I'm not the first person actually to parallel the flood to the Holocaust. There's, you know, if you look, you know, in books and online, and you'll begin to find that many people see parallels between the destruction of the world described in the flood and the destruction of the Jewish world described or lived through in the Holocaust. And I'll read to you one poem, which I have here, the source in Hebrew, and I'll try and see if I find, I think I have the source in English also somewhere. Where did I put it? Yeah. So the source goes like this. It's a poem called Ararat. Ararat is the mountain where Noah's ark landed. Okay? And so already you get the idea. He's going to talk about the aftermath of the flood, right? It's called the mountain, the landing point of the ark, okay? And here's the poem. It's 12 short verses. When all the survivors of the ark burst onto dry land, and in the muddled joy, really it's the in this in Hebrew it says the simchat irbuvia, in the joy of being all mixed together, they chattered and roared and shouted for prey, meaning for food. And they cried to be fruitful and multiply. And above their heads the rainbow hints, there will never be another end. But the end came. For the fish, with no worries, that lived off the disaster like flexible profiteers, now on the surface of the congealing earth, with unruly fins that were caught, with mouths wide open, they drowned in the air. So now,
thank you for joining, Marcus.
What is this going on here? Okay, got stuck here. Yeah. Okay. So what is being described here is sort of difficult to understand. We can see he's using terminology of Noah and the Ark and the Flood, and he's also mixing in some terminology of the Holocaust, like he says in Hebrew, it's the Nitzolei HaTeva, the survivors, which is really in Hebrew a very specific word that's used for the survivors of the Holocaust. Now, what's difficult is that he says that the rainbow is this sign that there won't be another end, but then he says there is an end. And then we talk about these profiteers, the fish. So if you look at the verses, there's really 12 verses, and the first six parallel the second six in what's known as a chiastic form. If you know in poems, right, you have the first verse to the last verse, the second to last, and so forth. So if you begin to understand that, you see that the sixth verse is where it says there will be no further end. The end, there will be never an end like there was in the flood. And then he says, and there is an end. So those two sort of mirror off each other, and the first six verses are talking about the aftermath of the flood, the aftermath of the Holocaust from the Jewish point of view. And the second six are talking about the aftermath of the Holocaust from the point of view of the Nazis and their collaborators. So the first, and that's why they're like upside down. They're exactly opposing each other. And so if you go through the verses, so it says, when all the survivors of the Ark burst onto dry land, and then on the last verse about the Nazis is, with mouths wide open, they drowned in the air. Basically, the exact aftermath of the Holocaust, the landing of the Ark, gave life to the people on the Ark, and it made death to those other people who thought that they had such a great time, meaning the fish. The only people that survived, or the only creatures that survived the flood, were the fish. But if all the water goes away, as it were, there are fish stuck in the mountains, and they die. And so what he's saying is that the Jews were like on this, were like coming off of this ark, being, they were the ones who were the survivors who somehow managed to survive the flood, survive the destruction of the Holocaust. And so now they can live on dry land, whereas they couldn't in the water. And just the opposite, the fish, who he's paralleling to Nazis and their collaborators, who were profiteers, that they profited off of this situation. So now they are drowning in the air, meaning that whole situation where they were able to like take advantage of this flood has now turned its head on them. Okay, so now he goes on, and we'll just look at a couple of verses from what he said in what he said about the Jews. So he said that they had this, you know, simchat irbuvia, that they were joyous altogether, which means that before they lived in isolation, they weren't allowed to really be together or rejoice together. Now you can imagine everybody got out, they were released, and they were finally able to be social. And then it says, and they chatted, and they roared, and they screamed for food, basically. And so, you know, that's also the joy of being able to eat. And then that they cried for being fruitful and multiplying. Basically, we're talking about, right, being fruitful and multiplying and having food, all the basic physical needs that they were deprived of, both in the Holocaust and in the Ark. I mean, in the Ark, as we'll see, they weren't allowed to have relations with each other, and of course the food must have been quite limited. So now, the last piece, it says, and out over their heads, the rainbow hinted, right? So now, what exactly was the rainbow hinting, and what does this rainbow really mean? So that we'll see in the story of Noach, and try to see how that really fits, what is really the hope for the Jews that left the Holocaust, okay? So now, if we go to the Parsha of Noach, so the very first words in the Parsha, it starts, Ela toldot Noach, Noach ish tzadik tamim haya b'dorotav, et Elohim hitalech Noach. So Noach was a righteous man. Okay, Noach was a righteous man. He was he was not only righteous tzaddik, he was tamim, meaning that he was whole in a good way with God. And he was, and it says now all of this was in relation to the generation that he lived in, and he walked with God. Et Elohim, Hitalech Noach. So Noach walked with God. Okay, so he's a special person. He's very well connected to God, and now God comes and tells him, listen, the whole world is corrupt, people are immoral, and I've had it, I'm destroying the world, I'm going to save you and your family, make an ark, bring the animals, we know the story. Right? Yeah. So now, in between here, he says, so God says, "Ubata ela teva ata uvanecha ishtecha unushnei vanecha itach." So he says, "I want you and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives to go with you." Right? So now, Rashi says, "What? That's a funny order. Why is saying? Why doesn't it say you and your wife and them and their wives? It says you and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives." So Rashi says, "Ha'anashim levad, hanashim levad, mikan shene'asru b'tashmish hamita." So he says, we learn from this that the men had to stay together and the women stayed together. And we learn from this that they were forbidden to have relations on the ark. Later he says that, you know, when there's a catastrophe and a crisis in a society, so you're not allowed to have relations because now you're like, you're sort of like turning your head on the destruction that's going on. So it's interesting that both in the Holocaust and in the Ark, sort of the same living conditions in a way were going on. Okay, now that the verses go on, and I'm in chapter 6, verse 19. Mikol achai, mikol basar shnayim, mikol tavi el hateva lahachayot itach zachar nekeva yiyu. So he says you have to bring all the living creatures into the Ark in order to save them alive. And so this is like sort of a hint at what's the whole purpose of the ark. The purpose of the ark is to save some kind of remnant of society, to survive. Okay? So that's pretty clear. And then the last verse in verse 22, so it says, Vayas Noach kechol asher tziva oto Elohim kein asa. And so Noach did exactly what God commanded him. Noach is an obedient servant of God. He's a righteous man. He does what he's commanded. Okay? And so that, we all expect that, and we understand now what's going on. What's interesting is that in the next chapter, chapter 7, so it sort of repeats the same ideas a little bit differently. It says, you know, get the animals. This time it says, bring, instead of bringing two by two, it says also bring seven of the kosher animals. And he brings some other kind of explanations. He says here in verse 3, it says, lahachayot, it says to save them alive, but it says, lahachayot zera al panei kol haaretz, in order to preserve the seed on all the face of the earth. And so that's a kind of a different meaning of what's the purpose, which we'll see again, but it seems to be saying the same idea about surviving, but it seems to be saying it in a different way. Okay, and so we'll see what are the differences between these two descriptions. Now, the rest of the chapter, and going into chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9, is the whole story of the flood. The water comes, the water goes, the birds, the whole thing. And then we get to the very end. So how does the story really end? So the story ends kind of tragically, actually. So it says that Noah and his sons and the family, they got off, and now I'm in chapter 9, verse 20. So it says, Vayachel Noach ish ha'adama vayita karen. So it says, and so now Noach, the man of the earth, went and planted a vineyard. Okay? Vayesht, and now verse 21, Vayesht min hayayin vayishkar vayit gal. So now it says, and he drank from the wine that was from his vineyard, and he got drunk, and he got naked. Okay, and then his sons, his son Ham, somehow disgraced him. There's all kinds of explanations. Just looking at him naked was disgracing him. Some people say that he sodomized him. Some people say all kinds of different things. Yeah, there's different explanations in the Gemara and in the Midrashim about what could he have possibly done. Okay, some even say, there's even people who say that he slept with his wife, which shows that he is really like in charge. In the old times, sleeping with the king's wife meant you're the king. Unless the king would do something about it. In any case, the point is that this is a completely tragic ending to this wonderful, righteous individual who did whatever God said and saved the world alive. And all of a sudden, we find that he gets drunk, and he disgraces himself, and his son disgraces him. And then the very end, in verse 29, this is how the whole story ends. Vayu kol yemei Noach 900 shana v'chamishim shana v'yamot. And so Noach lived to be 950 years old, and he died. That's it. Very unceremoniously. No one's there. No, what happened to that? He was walking with God. You know, there's a verse. It talks about Chanoch. So Chanoch, or in English, they call him Enoch. Something like that in English. Anyway, so they say that he also walked with God. And the verse says that when he died, it mentions again that it says here, it says, V'yitalech Chanoch et Elohim ve'einenu. And now he passed on. Okay? And so it's strange. If Noah walked with God, we would expected it to like give, that's like a really special description. We would have expected that also when he died as a sort of eulogy to also say, you know, here's a great man. He walked with God and now he passed away. But it just said, no, he lived this many years and he died. So what happened? What happened to Noah, the savior and really sort of the stepfather of the world, right? I mean, from him, the whole world was created anew. So what happened to Noah that he went down so hard? So basically, we have to go back to when he got off the boat. And there we'll find the key. So in chapter 8, God commands Noah to go and his family to get off the boat. Chapter 8, verse 16, it says, Tse mina teva ata v'ishtecha uvanecha uneshevach nelecha itach. So it says, now God tells him, I want you to go off the boat, off the ark, you and your wife, your sons and their wives. Oh, big difference. Before, God says, we don't want you guys to be together. Now he says, I want you to be together. Right now we have a job. Now we have to repopulate the world. Now we have to recreate the world. Okay? So now, but what does Noah do? Noah is the guy who said, we said he does everything that God tells him, right? So look what happens in verse 18. Vayetze Noah uvanav, v'ishto uneshev anav ito. He goes off just like he got on. Him and his sons, his wife, and the women. So now Noah is disobeying God's command. Noah is not playing the game anymore. Noah is not the Ish Tzaddik that he was. He is refusing the command of God. And this is what the commentators say. There's a commentator called Toldot Yitzchak, who was the grandson of Yosef Karo, and also the Abarbanel, who write that from here you can see that Noah was not interested in populating the world. Okay? And so what does he say? So why? Why isn't he? I mean, you know, here we have this straight guy, listens to God, does what he tells him to do. He knows what's going down. What happened? So the Abarbanel says like this. Ein safek shenoach uvanav betzeitam min ha-teva hayu mishtomemim umitablim al ha-avar yireim umpochadin min ha-atid. So he says, there is no doubt that Noach and his sons, when they got off the ark, were stunned, and they were in shock and mourning over the past that was lost and destroyed, and they were in fear of the future, of what would be with this world. You know, parallel this exactly to the people who left the camps, right? And they saw the world destroyed. They were in shock. What are they going to do? So now the Barbanel explains that God saw that they were in distress. And so he came and he told Noah and his sons and the family, and he said, look, now this is chapter 9. Vayvarach Elohim et Noach et ve'et banav vayomer lahem pru urvu umelu et ha'aretz. So he says exactly the command that he gave to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, right? This world needs to be populated so that we can do the will of God and make creation what it was meant to be. And then there's all these verses where God tries to assuage his fears. There's all these fears that, you know, what will we eat, and what if the animals attack us, and what if, you know, the people that we make are as immoral as the people that were before, and everybody kills each other. And so God says, don't worry about it. You know, there's going to be morality, and it's forbidden. Now he gives them the command that it's forbidden to murder and all these kind of things. So then God ends again, and he says, "Va'atem pru uravu shirtzu ba'aretz uravu ba." He says, "Be fruitful and multiply greatly over the whole earth, and make a lot, replenish the earth." Basically, so again, the whole command for Noah when he's coming off of the boat is to rebuild, restart creation. And Noah says, I can't do it. I don't believe anymore. So now, there's an interesting contrast that we mentioned before, that there were two points of the, there were two points to the whole story when Noah got onto the ark. Okay? The first one we said it was that he was getting on the ark to save the world alive. L'hachayot. Right? And then the second one was L'chayot Zera al Panei Kol Haaretz, and to make the seed of all the earth alive. So now there's a Rav Hanoch Waxman who teaches in Yeshivat Haratzion, and he wrote a whole article about this story, and he explains that this contrast, these two different the two different explanations of the goal of creation, the goal of the ark. So the first one, he says, l'chayot, to save everybody alive, that's just to survive. You need to survive physically. So you get on the ark and you save yourself alive. But he says, but the second one says to preserve the seed. A seed is talking about the future, right? So he says, this is actually talking about a second goal of making the ark, and that is to preserve the world and recreate it. Renaissance. Leida mechadash. To have a rebirth of the world. There were two goals in bringing Noah and his family into the ark. The one was to help them survive physically. The second one was to create a family that would then recreate the whole world. We need to start the world again. Okay, so now, what happened was that Noah could not take it. Noah got off and he basically lost faith. And he said, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't listen to God's commands. I can't see it. It doesn't make sense to me anymore. The world is destroyed. Everything I knew is destroyed. Everyone I knew is dead. You want me to rebuild? I can't do it. And we can understand that, right? I mean, there are people who came out of the concentration camps and with that attitude, and it's 100% understandable. So, but what about the people who did manage to rebuild, who did manage to maintain their sanity, who did manage to maintain their faith? So that brings us back to Saul Teichman, who was one of those kinds of people, okay? He also had to get off of a boat when he left Europe, right? And it's an amazing thing. It's exactly the contrast between Noah and Saul Teichman. So when Saul Teichman and his brother were on a ship with all these American soldiers going from Europe back to America. And when they arrived in New York City, it was Shabbat. It was the middle of Shabbat. Now, everybody on the boat was ready to get off and rush to the exits. And Saul and his brother sat on the boat, and they didn't move. And so then the boat was completely empty, and the crew came over to them and said, "You have to get off the boat." And they said, "We can't get off the boat." The halacha is that if you're on a boat on Shabbat, you can't get off on Shabbat. And so now they told the crew, "It's against our religious principles." Now the crew knew that they were Holocaust survivors, and they said, "Okay, there's nothing we can do. We're not going to force you to violate your religion." They left them on the boat on Shabbat, and the rest of New York City heard about it. Motzei Shabbat, they walked the plank off the boat, and the whole dock was filled with reporters to greet these Holocaust survivors that wouldn't get off the boat because of their religion. And the title, the headlines in the paper were "Teichman Brothers Refuse to Get Off the Boat on Shabbat." So now, Saul Teichman, in his book, he writes, "In retrospect, our decision to stay on board and keep Shabbos is almost hard to comprehend. After everything we had been through, after everything we had endured, you would think that we would spirit off the ship for the safety of America. But Shabbos was Shabbos, and observing the halacha was our personal triumph over Hitler's attempt to eradicate Yiddishkeit." So here you see his faith. But it wasn't just that he managed to keep his faith. He managed to keep his faith because he kept his faith. You understand? The way he kept his faith was by keeping his faith. It's an amazing thing. You know, if the minute you lose your faith, it's lost. It's all in your hands. And so he was able to maintain his faith and not only see that it wasn't just about surviving. It wasn't just about living physically and getting off the boat and going and eating and sleeping and doing all the things that people do physically. He realized that was no victory over the Nazis. The victory is to live, but to live as a Jew, because that's what they wanted to eliminate. And so here, he was able to see the power of not only his physical survival, but his spiritual survival. And that's really the whole secret of his being able to continue not only just to live, but to thrive. Because the faith that he was able to maintain also gave him and gives us purpose. Without faith, we have no real purpose in this world. We go about our business and we do all of our physical things, but if there's no greater purpose, if there is no spirituality, the world and life empties out of a meaning very quickly. And that brings us to the final piece, which is the rainbow. So the end of that story in chapter 9 is that God comes and says, "I'm making my covenant with you, the covenant of the rainbow." And he says this word covenant, the word brit, in this paragraph where he describes the covenant and the rainbow and that I won't bring another destruction. The word brit comes up 7 times. 7 represents creation, the 7 days of creation. And so God is saying, this is a new covenant. It's the covenant of creation. What is this covenant of creation? It's a deal between you and me, between God and man, that we will work together to make a moral society, that we will work together to recreate the world, to populate the world, and to live in harmony and to live by my will. And so that's what this rainbow is about, and that's what this hope of this that the rainbow hints, not only over the ark and Mount Ararat, but over the exits of the concentration camps, that what really gives the power to the people to continue is that covenant between God, that there is a creator, and that he has a beautiful purpose for us, for all of mankind, to live in peace and harmony through the morality that is the Torah. And once we connect to that, so then we don't just survive, we thrive. And that is the secret of the eternity of the Jew. Now, let me try and turn this thing off.